This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll speak with an author and journalist, Michael Pollan, about the current resurgence of research into psychedelic drugs.
I had a series of these experiences in order to write the book. I was very reluctant and nervous before everyone in a way that I don't think a 20-year-old would be.
And we'll hear more about the proposed Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary and what various stakeholders in the Central Coast waters think about it.
The United States and California have such strong laws already. There isn't really a lot other stuff that the sanctuary management does to protect the environment.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 22nd, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. First up, author and journalist Michael Pollan is renowned for his books on topics like the food industry, nutrition, and plants. But his latest book is on psychedelic drugs. Moreover, the book includes Pollan's exploration of LSD and psilocybin as part of a larger conversation about a current revival of scientific research into these and other psychedelic substances, and how they may be used as medicines to help with things like PTSD, depression, and addiction. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart in conversation with Michael Pollan.
In the interest of transparency, I have a personal connection to you in that you were my graduate school advisor at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And do you still teach there?
Well, I'm on leave from Berkeley at the moment and teaching at Harvard in the fall semester. But I'll be returning to Berkeley before long.
I remember when I read Botany of Desire when it came out in 2001 and being struck by the totally novel idea that plants were the ones cultivating us, so to speak, evolving mm-hmm. to make themselves more attractive to us so that we would perpetuate their species. In this latest book, do you suggest the same phenomenon is at play with mushrooms or other natural psychedelics?
Some of them, yeah. The mushroom, the psilocybin mushroom, which sometimes called magic mushrooms, are a very interesting species because they produce this chemical that has these profound effects on the human mind. And it doesn't appear to be a defense chemical. The chemical doesn't appear in the whole body of the fungus, most of which is below ground. It appears in the fruiting body, which in general, they're not as concerned with defending. So one of the theories, and we're not sure about this, but one of the theories is that humans and other animals that like to get high selected these mushrooms, ate the ones that had this quality, and spread their spores around. And we know in recent years, humans have moved these mushrooms around quite a bit just from where they appear. And they pop up in funny places, like on university campuses, in front of police stations, and along the trails, not in the middle of the woods, but along the trails where people carry them. When I went hunting for psilocybes with Paul Stamets, I thought we'd be wandering way off out of the parking lot to find them and away from the campsite. But in fact, we found most of the ones we found very close to the campsites. So they'd been spread by other people who'd been hunting mushrooms. So for the mushroom, the production of this strange molecule has been a huge benefit and has given it much more habitat than it ordinarily would have had.
In the book, you talk a lot about the default mode network. Can you explain what this is and how it relates to psychedelics?
Sure. Well, one of the most interesting and curious findings of the research in the last couple of years, ever since this renaissance of psychedelic research got underway a few years ago, has been taking brain scans of people on psychedelics to see what's going on in the brain. And they actually get volunteers to take psilocybin or LSD, and they slide them into an MRI machine and watch what's going on in their brain in real time. And the expectation had been that there would be lots of fireworks, that you would see, lots more brain activity, because that's certainly how it feels to people. But in fact, they were surprised to find that one particular very important brain network, called the default mode network, was downregulated, quieted by the psilocybin. And this is an area of the brain, or a set of linked structures in the brain, that links the prefrontal cortex to areas of the brain involved with memory and emotion, and areas of the brain in general that have a lot to do with generating our sense of being a self, of having an ego. And this is where self-reflection takes place, and theory of mind, the ability to impute mental states to other beings, time travel. And this part of the brain, this network, went very quiet. And that correlated with the volunteers' reports of ego dissolution, this sense that their self was disappearing on a high-dose trip. So that was an interesting surprise. And the next surprise was that a researcher at Yale who was doing similar work with long-term meditators, putting them in the MRI machine and having them meditate, he was getting a very similar scan. And they, too, were having this quieting of the default mode network, which, you know, kind of makes sense since loss of ego or suppression of ego is part of what happens during long-term meditation. But it's been an interesting finding because it suggests that, it's helping us pinpoint where the self lives and that it is a function of the brain that can be turned on and off.
When you say quieting, does that mean is there less blood going there or is there more?
Yeah, they measure it a few different ways. But the first way they did it was cerebral blood flow. And blood flow is a proxy for activity. But they've also looked at oxygen consumption, another proxy for activity. And I think they've done it also with EEGs, with electrical, measuring electrical energy, which is a more direct, measure of what's going on. So the different modalities have all come to the same conclusion, that the default mode network, which is, by the way, one of the kind of regulatory networks of the whole brain. I mean, it's, as one of the researchers described it to me, it's the orchestra conductor or corporate executive of the brain. And so when you quiet that part of the brain, other parts of the brain are let off the leash, as this researcher put it. And they suddenly start talking to one another without going through this central hub of the default mode network. And that may be what gives you some of the strange phenomenology of a psychedelic trip. You know, the fact that you can, smell a musical note or see it. Synesthesia, that may be because parts, the visual cortex may be talking directly to the auditory centers in a way they don't normally. And so the brain appears to be temporarily rewired in the absence of this, regulator. And that rewiring may be part of what is allowing people to have new insights, connect the dots in different ways, and break out of habitual patterns of thought. The way one scientist put it to me just yesterday, I thought it was a nice analogy. The brain normally operates like a big airline like United or Delta or American, where they're always funneling into, you can't go from right to your destination. You have to go through a hub. And that's the brain under normal circumstances. On psychedelics, it's more like Southwest Airlines. It just goes everywhere.
Okay, well, let's talk about that rewiring and people using psychedelics in order to make that rewiring happen. For myself, the summer I was 22, I think I was, I was dropping acid like every other day. And the Dead were still around, so I was going to Dead concerts in Vermont and stuff. But, I was indestructible, but I haven't done it for a long, long time. I'm in my late 40s now, and I just feel a lot more mentally vulnerable, and yet I desire the most some rewiring. So can you talk about middle-aged people using it?
It's interesting. Well, as we get older, we're more invested in the status quo, I think, and psychedelics represents a threat to that or a challenge to that. We have our habits, and we've developed hopefully a pretty strong ego, and the idea of throwing the dice, and someone put it to me that way. A friend said, "Do you really want to roll the mental dice?" And that was a little scary. And I definitely had, we should tell listeners that, I had a series of these experiences in order to write the book. And I was very reluctant and nervous before everyone in a way that I don't think a 20-year-old would be. I mean, I think, you know, when you're in your 20s, especially males in their 20s, there's, you know, their judgment centers haven't really matured and they're risk takers. It's a reason we send 18-year-olds off to war. But as you get older and more settled, yeah, it feels very destabilizing. But that's sort of the point. The people who benefit most are people who need to be destabilized, because they're in the case of people with mental illness that are doing this, they're stuck. You know, they're like a window that's been painted over and can't move anymore, and they have to break out of their habits. And this does that. These drugs appear to lubricate cognition in a way that for some people is really helpful.
Okay. The last question on kind of the tripping itself, you talk about set and setting. Can you just explain for our listeners who haven't read the book, what is set and setting?
Sure. Well, these were terms actually first used, as far as we know, by Timothy Leary, the notorious LSD researcher, and I put that word in quotes, at Harvard in the early 60s. And he noticed, as other people before him had, that the kind of trip you had depended to a remarkable extent on the setting you were in and the mindset you brought to it. So if you were already feeling anxious and you're in, you know, I don't know, and you're in this on the subway in New York City and you take LSD, you're going to really have probably a really miserable experience. So the researchers learned early on that if you optimized the set and setting, which is to say the interior and exterior environment in which the trip took place, that you would get much better results and much gentler trips or more less negative trips. And the drugs are remarkably suggestible. So if you go into them with a certain intention, or even if you're in a trial where the researcher has a certain orientation, say, towards spirituality, you will in turn have a more spiritual experience. And that's a remarkable quality of these drugs. You know, when you think about most drugs, you can predict pretty much what the experience is like across a wide range of people, whether it's an opiate experience or a cocaine experience or an alcohol experience. And there is a remarkable amount of variability in the psychedelic experience. No two trips are alike. And they're very much a product of your mind, and therefore, you know, where your mind is when you embark.
You can actively guide it, like if you say, you know, trust and let go, or...
Yeah, you can do things to change the course of it. That's part of the mindset. Getting that right is what are called the flight instructions that researchers give you in these trials, and they'll tell you. Surrender. You know, if you feel like you're going crazy, or your mind is you know, your ego is dissolving, or you're dying, you know, surrender to it. Don't fight it. The bad trip comes when people try to fight what's happening in their mind, and that's great advice, as it turns out. And if you see something scary, go toward it. Don't run away. And in general, yeah, John Lennon had it right. You know, relax your mind and float downstream. And that continues to be the wisdom on the matter.
Right. Okay. How has your audience that you've garnered over, you know, 30 years? I mean, it's pretty radical departure from your usual fodder in some ways, right? I mean, how has your audience embraced or not embraced this book as opposed to your past?
Well, you know, I was very nervous about that. I thought that I would have a lot of annoyed readers, and that they were expecting me to, you know, stick to my food subject. But in fact, people have been remarkably open to it, and there is more interest in psychedelics among people who are passionate about food than I expected. So there's a, you know, there's kind of these communities, you know, the kind of community of interest that I plug into, something unified these topics in my mind. And I think that was true for a lot of readers too. And I thought when I went out on book tour, I'd have to explain, let me tell you why I did this change and justify it. But I didn't. They were just fine to go with me to this new place. And, you know, it has to do with nature, which has always been my subject. And the connection I didn't see coming was health, that my readers you know, think of me as someone who has something of value to tell them about their health, nutritional health, physical health, it's true. And now I was talking about mental health. But of course, those two things are closely related. And so I guess some of the authority I had built up with readers around the subject of health transferred more than I ever expected it would.
That was KCBX's Greta Mart in conversation with author and journalist Michael Pollan. Pollan will be in Santa Barbara Tuesday evening giving a talk as part of the current season of UCSB Arts and Lectures. The event is sold out. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Now we're going to hear part two of the audio to a recent documentary entitled Sacred Waters, produced by filmmaker Courtney Gerard. Sacred Waters features the stakeholders in a proposal to designate a new marine sanctuary off the Central Coast. The Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary application is spearheaded by Northern Chumash Tribal Council and supported by many, but it also has opponents. In the film, Gerard explores the sanctuary's nomination. We aired the first half earlier this month, and we've posted the documentary itself to our website at kcbx.org. So head there to watch Gerard's complete 24-minute documentary.
Marine protected areas are regions of the ocean that preserve and protect biological and cultural integrity. Marine sanctuaries are a type of marine protected area. They operate in both state and federal waters. The U.S. Congress passed the National Marine Sanctuaries Act in 1972. The act gives the Secretary of Commerce the power to designate marine sanctuaries if an area is threatened. In 2015, the Northern Chumash Tribal Council filed a proposal with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration to have a marine sanctuary designated off their homeland. The designation would protect the ecosystems the Chumash historically relied upon and their cultural antiquities that have been lost to the sea.
Some of these members of the sanctuary, our neighbors just off the coast, are truly spectacular. We have one of the largest migrations on the planet. We have some amazing rockfish. There are 7 species of whales and 6 species of dolphins and porpoise that transit through this proposed sanctuary area. We have the space intermittently used throughout the year by the largest animal on the planet, the blue whale, an endangered species, an animal whose heart is so large that you could swim right into its heart vessels, right? Lots of unique space that provides home for this special life. The proposed sanctuary right here in our backyard matters a great deal to a marine biologist. And to a marine biologist, there's a lot of teaching here because having a laboratory, a living laboratory, an underwater laboratory is a huge asset to all of us. It's one thing to sort of bring it alive on a PowerPoint presentation. It's another to take students, put masks on them, get underwater and see all that life. You learn it better, you understand it better, and importantly, you're inspired by it. So these students get out of the water and they care about it and they understand it and they take that passion forward. This is a truly unique space and it's at risk. We have to look after it to make sure it's there for generations going forward.
The best examples I can give on the West Coast of how national marine sanctuaries have benefited ecosystems include broad-based protections for benthic habitats, right? So all those activities that can harm the seafloor, those are prohibited inside a marine sanctuary. Kelp forest conservation has taken place inside marine sanctuaries. Water quality discharges are prohibited into a sanctuary, whether that's discharges that come out of harbors or even pesticides and nutrients that flow from ag fields into the marine sanctuary. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds annually don't enter the sanctuary that would have otherwise if these programs weren't in place.
First blush, you think a marine sanctuary might be a good idea to protect your ocean, because we're all about keeping the ocean clean. Without doing a lot of investigation, you think, oh, this might be a great idea. Before you make any decision, you certainly want to do your homework. So as I began to personally delve into it so that we could better represent the city, really found that there's some drawbacks to having the designation as a marine sanctuary. There's already so much interest and protections on our coastline that I can't even imagine that there would be any offshore oil drilling in our bay.
In 2016, water quality surveys ranked the water south of the Pismo Beach Pier the 10th dirtiest out of California's 456 beaches. Tests revealed unsafe levels of fecal indicator bacteria from bird, animal, and human waste.
I'm concerned that it would impact public safety. I'm concerned it would slow down potential local control if we had projects that we needed to do. And I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth, how it would affect the fishing industry here in our area.
I've never seen a healthier ocean than I see right now. The otters, the whales, the fish, everything is thriving. And maybe that's due to some regulations, but I think it just goes in spurts. Fishing could be good 1 year, and then something might happen like an El Nino, and it slows it down a little bit. The bait goes away, so you don't see all the whales. It's all a cycle. So just because we're not catching certain types of fish now, that doesn't mean we're not gonna catch them next year.
1974 was my first commercial fishing trip. My girlfriend's father bought a tuna boat. After school was out that year, he told me to get on the boat and we're leaving. I was gone for 4 months, and I didn't have a girlfriend when I got home. And ever since then, I've been fishing. I have 3 kids. Ben is just, he's our last one. He's taking marine science at Cuesta. He'll probably fish. I'm not going to sell my shrimp permit when I retire, so somebody's going to have to run the boat.
I do think fishermen need to be concerned to pay attention to the issue of a new sanctuary. Since I've come to Monterey, I've either been on or attended nearly every Sanctuary Advisory Council meeting for over 20 years. There's been, some long-standing frustrations with the sanctuary program. The sanctuary's strong interest in creating these no-fishing zones. And many fishermen viewed that as both a breach of the promise made to them, but also interference with the lawful agencies that manage fisheries and have a science basis to manage those fisheries.
On the coast of California, fisheries are managed by the National Marine Fisheries Service and the Pacific Fishery Management Council and the state of California, the California Fish and Game Commission, Department of Fish and Wildlife. We work with them, we provide advice, we provide support, we take them on our research vessels, we do education programs that benefit them, and on so many issues we're in very tight concert with those agencies. But they've got the main responsibility of ensuring fish stocks are healthy, that fishermen catches is what it is, and try to find science and information that helps benefit fishing and fisheries management. It's not our job, though. We're not allowed to manage fishing, and we don't want to manage fishing. And that's their responsibility, not ours.
For the nearshore fishery, we have a really strict fishery, and it's a real good fishery because we kind of self-regulate ourselves by throwing back all the large fish, and we also use a ring in our traps, a 5-inch ring, to keep the otters out. But nobody ever caught an otter. I'm one of the stewards of the ocean to the end, We have enough restrictions and enough areas in the reserve status that we can't go to anymore, that the fish really don't need to be protected from anything.
Fishermen in California already comply with at least a half dozen federal and state regulations aimed toward the preservation of marine life. While some of these regulations limit their quotas, others prohibit fishermen from fishing in designated areas.
It's a challenging time for fishermen, right? And fishermen are concerned about their future, not just here on the West Coast, across the nation.
Because the fact that the United States and California have such strong laws already, there isn't really a lot other stuff that the sanctuary management does to protect the environment. I think the number one thing to me is that they're really good at inspiring, concern and care for the ocean. They create a forum as a central place to have people do things to care for the ocean. You know, anything from maybe cleaning a beach to checking water quality at streams in the wintertime. I mean, all those kind of things are opportunities the public wants to have, and the sanctuary creates a focal point for those things. They provide opportunity to also do collaborative work with different stakeholders, like, say, the agricultural community, you know, to advance voluntary water quality programs. They've got an education program, and these are all really, you know, good things. On the other side, things like sometimes the lack of transparency and the lack of use of science in decision making have also been troublesome.
There's not going to be any oil wells drilled here. If that's what they're trying to protect us from, it's a mute point. They're not going to do that.
There are significant reserves offshore California, so the possibility of expansion or increased production is always there.
Given the new administration and given the changes that we're seeing and the transitions, people are really coming out in support. It seems to be a threat and a clear and present danger that oil and gas production is going to increase.
I hope more and more people will understand that not only did we have the privilege to take from the land, and still the privilege to take from the land, and even if it's indirectly, but we have always the responsibility to take care.
In modern history, in the last 200 years, we haven't treated it very well. And the Chumash have the spirit and the culture and the values of ocean stewardship, and I'd like to bring those back.
And I don't think anything that anybody can tell us would change the way we feel about the fact that people want to drill off of our coast.
This proposed sanctuary is like a living time capsule out there underwater. It's like what California was 15,000 years ago. We have amazing animal migrations. We have amazing underwater cathedral kelp forests, and it's at risk. We've really radically changed the amount of wildness, the integrity of the nature on land. It's a special thing to have that wildness still alive in this proposed sanctuary. Not too dissimilar from what a California was like when the Chumash were here living along the coast. It's a very special thing to have that kind of California, that part of California history, alive, and it's at risk.
We have to just keep getting out there and showing up, and that's the key. I think in the past, I think one of the main reasons that, you know, we have this type of administration is a lot of people just didn't get up off the couch and get up and stand. Oil is propelling this thing. Everybody's voice matters.
Take a step so that we don't ever see lights out there on our coast. So all of the indigenous people that are here and all the indigenous people that will come will know that we were able to preserve the viewshed, the same viewshed that our ancestors 15,000 years ago saw, will hopefully be seen 15,000 years into the future.
You've been listening to the audio of a recent documentary entitled Sacred Waters, produced by filmmaker Courtney Gerard. Sacred Waters features the stakeholders in a proposal to designate a new marine sanctuary off the Central Coast. If you have any questions about who is speaking in the audio we just heard, head to kcbx.org, where we've posted the documentary. All speakers are identified in the video. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we're going to learn some Central Coast history of missions, as well as the importance of libraries.
Whether the library is in a building or in a home or it's on a tablet, there's a world there worth exploring.
This story and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's often said that if we don't know our history, we don't know who we are or where we're going. All of us need to know a lot more about local history. In a sense, our history is who we are. Brian Reynolds recently sat down with local historian Joe Caratanuti for a discussion about historical subjects dear to the hearts of residents on the Central Coast, the missions, the city of San Luis Obispo, public libraries, and more.
So wonderful to have you here. We were friends and colleagues for years when I was county library director. I always enjoyed talking with you and seeing your latest articles about history and understanding some of the challenges of being a historian, and which are many. We're going to talk about some of those today. Could you tell us a little bit about sort of where you came from and, you know, your career and how you came up to move to the Central Coast and become one of our preeminent historians?
Well, I retired after 30 years in public education, and I was always interested in missions and mission history, and my daughters went to Cal Poly, and it was a natural move for us to the Central Coast. And from there, I started researching the mission and wrote my first booklet on the Mission San Luis. And from there to the city history, and then from that to the library history and so forth.
Just a tidbit about the missions. There's 21 of them in California, correct?
Yes.
And I believe they're all functioning in some fashion?
No. Some of them are strictly historical sites.
So like museums.
And that's right. Many of them are not in populated areas, or they're very little left of the original mission.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's really no original mission. What we have today are years and years of renovation and redecoration and so forth.
I guess I was reading once where adobe is a wonderful building material.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't do well in the rain over the years unless you whitewash it or treat it somehow.
Absolutely. On the other hand, Mission San Juan Capistrano was originally built with rock. And when the earthquake came, that collapsed.
Huh.
So adobe was the only material really the missionaries had. And it's true, it needed to be preserved with whitewash.
Yeah. Now, I could be wrong, but I think this is accurate, that when we were part of Mexico and Spain, we had another name here. We were Alta California, Upper California.
Mm-hmm.
And Baja was Baja or Lower.
Right.
And there was a string of missions as well in Baja California, maybe 40, I'm not sure, but many of them. Is that correct?
Yes, the missions in Baja California were all founded by Jesuits. And actually, Junipero Serra, who founded our mission in San Luis, actually founded his first mission in Baja.
Interesting.
And then he moved to San Diego.
I've heard there's a bit of a controversy. Are these buildings, some museums, some churches, are they missions anymore, or are they churches? I would guess if they are active in terms of worship, they're more of a church than a mission.
Yes. They were all meant to become a part of a pueblo. The Spanish were not interested in having an unpopulated area. The objective, especially in Alta California, was to create pueblos. And then the mission would be the community church, if you say.
Yeah, more or less the center of town.
Yes.
Is there any truth to the allegation that in terms of the treatment or mistreatment of Native Americans, that the priests, the religious folk, often found themselves on the side of the natives to take care of them and protect them from harm or slave labor, that kind of thing?
Well, absolutely. The history differs with each mission, with each missionary, with each location. Because we have one state doesn't mean that the natives that were here thought of themselves as one unit. Different tribes, different languages, lack of communication between them. So the Padres quite often were confronted with not being able to communicate, and Sarah, who is a very well-educated, highly educated man, that was his most frustrating experience, trying to communicate with the natives when he was here, once they were baptized.
Hmm. Yeah, I read somewhere, I think this is accurate, that the Romance languages, just take that, which came down from Latin, the countries nearby Italy and ancient Rome, had similar languages, French, Portuguese, Italian. But in many areas of the United States, you had Indian languages that were far different from each other. They might be cheek by jowl, but it might be this, like Italian and Chinese. They were not linguistically connected.
Correct. And so, and quite often, this would be a problem with a mission where you would have different groups eventually joining a mission community. And one of the myths out there by those who don't read their history or know it very well is they weren't forced to do this.
Were not forced
to join. But when they did join, then the language, not only between the Spanish-speaking padres and soldiers, but also between the languages of the natives themselves. So this is the linguistic challenges are immense in mission history.
Interesting. And I'm assuming there's no written record in any of the Indian languages.
No, what's most interesting is the first written language, native language, is Franciscan. They would listen to the natives speaking and attempt to transcribe the sound into the Spanish language, and so they for the catechisms, and they've left quite a record of languages for the individual tribes.
Wow, I had no idea.
That's the first written language that I know of.
Speaking of that, I seem to remember another thing. All these ideas are coming up that at UC Santa Barbara, there's a big focus on Native American history and early California history. Is that accurate?
Oh, yes. The archives are there.
Right.
Santa Barbara has some magnificent archives. It was a Franciscan novitiate, if you wanted, the training. So they have an enormous collection of original documents.
Huh. Probably artifacts and so forth. Let's zero in a little bit on our local mission and the local native, the Chumash. Was there anything unique about our mission, made it stand out from the others?
Well, I think it was unique in that it was very peaceful. The natives here actually supported, we don't have time to go into the founding, but on September 1st, 1772, when Sarah was here to found the mission, he left the next day, and he left one padre, which was most unusual, and about five soldiers and a couple of Baja natives. And when I talk about this era, I said, and enough supplies to fill the back of an SUV. So the natives here were very supportive of the of the missionaries that were left. Hmm. There was no farming. There's no store. You either grew it to eat it, or you found it and hunted it or picked it off a tree.
Now, the main native tribe here was the Chumash.
Chumash, yes.
I've heard that's not a real name. It like means shell people, whatever their real name was, a different name, maybe secret.
Sarah called them Tixlini, T-I-X-L-I-N-I. I don't do a lot of native history, but I do know that the studies of the language, they went from approximately today's Malibu north to the Great. And so that was a predominant area. And they found them to be very peaceful people by and far.
I was reading, I was a library director up in Northern California, and I was Siskiyou County for many years, and I was reading a history of some of the local tribes up there, the Kurucs and the Wintus and the Hoopas, and they were kind of fierce, and they were very careful not to share things they had. They allegedly wouldn't even get married because they would have to share their stuff.
Yes.
And that reminded the European explorers of the Plains tribes, who are also very fierce. And the allegation is that the Indian tribes are more fierce when the resources are scarce. Like the buffalo were always on the move, or water holes were intermittent. Whereas here, they say in Central California, it's rather abundant, deer and fish and acorns.
Could be. It certainly is possible. I've written a series called California 1814, and at that time there was a questionnaire from Spain, and each of the padres at each of the missions was required to answer these 35 or so questions, and it's quite a diverse series of answers. They were compiled and never sent back. So at Santa Barbara, the original is there, and they've been translated.
Were they meant to be sent back?
Yes, they were sent back. But remember, 1814 is in the middle of the Mexican Revolution. Spain has not sent ships to the missions. This is a whole nother story. And so the authorities in Spain, from what I'm gathering, wanted to know what was happening in the mission settlements in California. And this is a fascinating insight into the different groups at the different missions. Many of them have since disappeared.
Joe, let's shift our discussion to some of your efforts for other entities of historical value in the the city, the county libraries, the city library of San Luis Obispo.
Yes.
Can we talk about that?
Well, the city library is just marvelous. It was the first library in the county. It started in 1894 as a subscription library, and you paid a fee. They had books. Usually the books were donated. And 3 years later, it became a city responsibility. So in 1897, the San Luis Obispo City Library was founded. And it lasts until the end of 1972. And then it merged and became a branch of the county library. So we're in the situation where the city, the oldest library, became the newest branch of the county system.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, if my memory serves, there were two independent city libraries during that era, Paso Robles and San Luis Obispo, and they remained independent till this day.
Paso Robles has. Paso Robles never joined the county system. Both have the magnificent buildings designed by the same man about the same time and through the generosity of Andrew Carnegie, which is another whole story. And so both again, are community efforts. They were considered the a pillar of progress, that if you were going to have a progressive community, you had to have a library, and I believe to this day. Communities have civil government, and civil government runs the laws, the regulations, paving the streets, and on and on and on. But a library represents, the, to me, a whole different aspect of the human experience.
Of course.
And whether the library is in a building or in a home or it's on a tablet, wherever the library happens to be, there's a world there worth exploring.
Do you think libraries and history are linked as we sort of wind up our discussion? I mean, in some sense, there are two entities meant for the public that house history, museums and libraries, both important. What makes a library stand out?
Well, you know, I start my history of the city of, I wrote a history of the city of San Luis Obispo Library. And I started out, to paraphrase, that one of my earliest memories was the image of the burning of the library at Alexandria. Libraries are threats to tyrants. Libraries are threats to those who want to think one way and one way only. And governments, quite frankly, can force that through laws. But libraries are, in their own way, subversive activities.
We used to joke about this mythical library that you went out the door and the sign would say, you know, come back soon. If we didn't offend you, please go to the desk and we'll work on it.
Yes, yes. But I would certainly encourage folks to go to the library. We have a wonderful calendar, the limited edition, available for free. And it has many images that are in the calendar for the first time. They're in the library archives that I've worked on for 10, 15 years now, organizing a great deal of information.
Awesome. What was one final thought you'd like to leave with our audience?
I'd like to leave the thought that one is the Friends of the Library are having their annual luncheon May 2nd at the Madonna Inn, and I will be continuing on with the story there. I hope you can attend. We are dedicating the head marker for Margaret Milne on April 27th from 11 to 11:30 at the San Luis Cemetery.
Awesome. One final thing, you do have a website, joefromslo.com. Providing the only sequential history of the community to the 1920s.
Correct.
Thank you so much, Joe. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Joe Caratanuti, former educator and wonderful local historian. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Joe Caratanuti in conversation with Brian Reynolds talking about the history of the missions and libraries here on the Central Coast. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. And now let's return to the coast, specifically the vast stretch of sand dunes south of Pismo Beach and north of Guadalupe. California State Parks has proposed making pretty significant changes to the Oceano Dunes State Recreational Vehicular Area. One of those changes would be to create a new entrance to the off-roading area of the dunes by transforming the current Oso Flaco Lake natural area. KCBX's Greta Mart has more.
State Parks is in the process of creating a new long-term plan for Oceano Dunes, and it currently calls for turning the Oso Flaco Lake natural area into a paved RV campground, among other changes. Dan Canfield is the acting deputy director for the Off-Highway Vehicle Recreation Division of California State Parks.
It's a way for us to propose a group of projects that would be implemented over a long period of time under one package, as opposed to developing projects one at a time.
The current planning effort, called a Public Works Plan, or PWP, is a new vision, says Canfield, for the future use of Oceano Dunes. State Parks has made a website, www.oceanodunespwp.com, that describes all the proposed changes and plans. State Parks says it's trying to alleviate current problems like traffic, noise, pollution, and trash found along one of two current entrances to the off-roading area. Canfield says the Public Works Plan is described in the California Coastal Act.
The way that folks enjoy it and the way that people access it and the way the community is affected by the facility was established in 1982. And so as the community has grown up around our park has remained to be operated kind of under that 1982 model. And so that's become problematic in a lot of different respects for the operation and for the community and for our visitors.
One of the plans is called Project A, which is to create another entrance to the off-road vehicle area of the Oceana Dunes complex. Cara Woodruff is an advocate for the current Oso Flaco Natural Area. She says Project A would totally change an area that is now used by fishermen and women and bird and nature watchers.
Imagine going down there and imagine what it would be like if you now had a big area that was filled with cars and being staged for OHV activities and campsites and campfires and RVs and cabins and staff residences. Imagine how it would drastically change the experience at Oso Flaco. It would be day and night. It would be moving Grand Avenue, Pier Avenue down to the Oso Flaco Lake area, where it's totally different there now.
While State Parks has been working on this new plan for about a year, it was only recently that area residents learned about it, and many have expressed their opposition to the plan.
It has been oppressing Oceano, the beach, and the creek for the last 40 years. To have the off-road area on this beautiful stretch of beach and dunes is a huge burden. And Parks is not doing a good job at taking care of the negative consequences that their presence has.
Lucia Casalinuovo is a 30-year-plus resident of Oceano. She says for her, the main problems with Oceana Dunes is State Parks' mismanagement of the off-roading area since the 1980s, and the chronic dust problem kicked up by the vehicles, and the economic injustice Oceano has suffered over the years from the park's presence.
The beach and the park, I see it as a nice big old pie, delicious pie, of which everybody wants a slice. You know, everybody needs a chicken in her pot, right? Well, right now, the only ones to have a chicken in the pot are the off-roaders. So they have to reduce the numbers drastically, and they need to reduce the area in which they drive drastically so they can still have a piece of the pie, but they have to share. They cannot have it all.
The Public Works Plan would nullify some vitally important conditions of the 1982 operating permit, having to do with vehicular access to the dunes. As proposed, the Public Works Plan would obstruct Oceano's prospects for infrastructure and community development. That's one of the main concerns right now.
Nick Alter lives in Aurora Grande, but has been working with the Oceano Beach Community Association, serving as a community planning advisor over the past year. He sees the new plan for Oceana Dunes as contrary to the original terms of the agreement by which State Parks is able to run an off-roading park in San Luis Obispo County. The California Coastal Commission is the regulatory body for all things coastal in California, and Alter says State Parks' new plan doesn't mesh with current basic commission policies.
It would also conflict with the newly approved environmental justice policy of the Coastal Commission. So I don't see the Public Works Plan as moving forward without aligning itself with this new policy, which was adopted only a couple of weeks ago by the Coastal Commission.
But Dan Canfield of State Parks says the new plan is totally in line with California Coastal Commission policies, and the two agencies are working together on it.
The Public Works Plan we're working on comes right out of the California Coastal Act. It's a plan that is described in the California Coastal Act, and it's one that's governed by the California Coastal Commission. They're the folks that ultimately have the voting authority to approve development in the coastal zone. I mean, up and down the coast of California, you know, there are projects going on. There's hotels being built in the coastal zone. There's condominiums. There's resource conservation efforts. And the California Coastal Commission is the permitting agency for that. The Public Works Plan simply takes a group of projects envisioned over looking out over maybe one or two decades, packages them together for the Coastal Commission to consider. And so it's not circumventing the Coastal Act. It's basically just a way of trying to get a group of projects packaged in a way that the California Coastal Commission is looking at them as a package, not one at a time as they come to them. One campground development or one resource conservation effort, but as a total package.
Canfield says he's aware of the recent pushback for the new plan and welcomes it.
And that's exactly the type of thing that makes planning processes go forward. Oftentimes we struggle with projects and that we have trouble getting input from the recreating public or from our neighbors or from our stakeholders. That is certainly not an issue here. We are getting robust public engagement.
Next in the process is the creation of an environmental impact report. Canfield says there will be more opportunities for the public to weigh in at that point. Those who oppose the new plan vow to vigorously participate in defeating it. With KCBX News, I'm Greta Mart.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.